And we are off and running here. Good afternoon, Stan Turner with you. Thank you so much for your company. It's 12:06. You just heard the temperature, 55 degrees. Kyle, looking out your window, do we have that sunshine they've been promising, huh?
Well, it was peeking out a little bit, yeah. but I'm seeing a lot of clouds now.
Hiding and peaking, more hiding than peaking right
now.
Huh? Okay, well, fall is in the air, no doubt about that. On the way down this morning, some trees are starting to change color, so here we go. So happy to have you along with us today. We promise you a lively and, I'm sure, fascinating discussion on something that I know really occupies a lot of us. Next Tuesday, September the 24th, is the 117th anniversary of the birth of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Yep, the Jazz Age novelist was born in St. Paul, right up there on Cathedral Hill, and became a known literary figure by the time he was in his 20s. Didn't take him long. Fitzgerald is a fascinating character, known for his antics as well as his fine writing. He and his wife Zelda got publicly and stupendously drunk in some of the best places in Minnesota, in New York City, and in Europe. They were the it couple of the flapper era and scandalized people far and wide with their bad behavior. Somehow, through it all, Scott produced many epic novels and short stories. During the next little while, we visit in studio with a specialist. I call him an expert on F. Scott Fitzgerald, Dave Page. Lives and works in Minnesota. He teaches at times a college-level class on Fitzgerald's writing, and Dave has written about F. Scott widely. Dave Page's latest work deals with the teenage diary that F. Scott kept. F. Scott Fitzgerald called it his thought book, kept it locked under his bed as a teenager. It's now published in its entirety, or what we think is its entirety. As a teen, Fitzgerald already had an amazing command of the language, as we'll hear, even though he was a lousy speller. Welcome back, Dave Page. It's been a while.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Great to see you. David, we'll get to the thought book, F. Scott, the young F. Scott's diary that he kept under lock and key. And it really is what you might call the dawn of a writer. You know, the first sunrise. You can see what's going to happen down the road as he writes. But I want to take us back just briefly to this month, 1996. David, you were very much a part of it. That was the centenary of F. Scott Fitzgerald's birth, the 100th anniversary. And my golly, especially in St. Paul, all kinds of fun things were going on, right? Remember it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was a parade led by Garrison Keillor, of course. And Fitzgerald's grandkids were here.
Yep, they were.
And a lot of speakers, some incredible
people.
It
really was. And there's some zany things going on, too. The World Theater in downtown St. Paul was, I think, officially christened the Fitzgerald Theater. Somebody brought up a bucket of water from the Mississippi River and splashed it on the base of the building, christening it the Fitzgerald Theater. There was a statue erected during that time in Rice Park, still there. F. Scott Fitzgerald. Are the legs too short on that statue, David? It looks out of proportion to me. I like it. I'm glad it's there. It looks kind of strange to me.
Yeah, there's some interesting things about that statue. Michael Price, unfortunately, who passed away, made the statue. He made three different heads because he didn't like the original two. One of them was raffled off, and I'm upset because I didn't know about it and wasn't able to get a raffle ticket, but the other one ended up at the Fitzgerald Theater. And then when they made the movie, the Prairie Home Companion movie, at the end of the movie, someone takes the head and walks out of the theater with it, and they realized at that point they'd better, you know, get that head down there so nobody can swipe it, because it was just sitting there.
It's worth a ton. It is a wonderful statue. You know, if you look at it, the way Fitzgerald's head is pointed, he's almost looking at the bar at the St. Paul Hotel, isn't he? And there's a Women's Christian Temperance League plaque nearby, too.
Yeah.
Some ironies there, huh?
Yeah, and the fact that the prohibition laws were written right behind him in the landmark.
That's right. Another fine irony. And during the centenary of Fitzgerald's birth in 96 in St. Paul, they had vintage flapper clothes clothing exhibitions. They were wonderful, especially at Landmark Center. And dance lessons, those were fun. dances like the of the period, of the Fitzgerald era, the flapper era. The grizzly bear was one of them.
I remember that one.
That's a laugh riot. Let's see, they did the Black Bottom, the Big Apple, and, of course, the Charleston, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I think there were nonstop readings going on at the newly christened Fitzgerald Theater, too.
Yeah, they did.
You might have been reading some of those, huh?
You know what? I wasn't involved in the reading. I was doing a couple other things, but yeah, it was 24 hours.
It was about a week of really fun things.
Absolutely.
And it really underscored how popular F. Scott Fitzgerald is, not just only in his hometown of St. Paul, but far and wide. Like you say, people came in from everywhere. I think Fitzgerald's granddaughter, what's her name, Lanahan?
Bobby Lanahan.
Yeah, she came in. That's Scotty's daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think a lady named Ring, who was the last secretary to F. Scott Fitzgerald in California,
yeah,
she came in.
Yeah, she's
right?
written a book.
Yep,
absolutely.
Yep. Doesn't everybody, huh? You have too.
Yeah.
I met you and our late friend, your late collaborator, literary collaborator, John Koblis, during the 100th anniversary celebrations. You guys were out with a book, still around. I have a copy of it. Is it called Toward the Summit? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah. F. Scott in Minnesota, Toward the Summit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's out of print.
Yeah. Well, I have a copy, and I'm glad. Yeah. It's a great resource, too. So in the ensuing years, Dave, just about the general knowledge of F. Scott Fitzgerald since, let's say, just arbitrarily 1996, have we learned anything new, significantly new about F. Scott Fitzgerald? Has come out of the stacks and libraries, the dusty, musty files, anything that we didn't know then?
Well, there's a big international F. Scott Fitzgerald conference every other year, and it'll be held this November in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the town that, believe it or not, has the only Fitzgerald Museum in the world. And so I'm just telling you that if you go to one of those conferences, people are presenting papers on Fitzgerald that are just fascinating. I heard a paper about electricity in the work of F. Scott Fitzgerald, for example.
What?
And I know it sounded kind of lame, but it was just fascinating.
Electricity in his writing.
Because electricity was kind of new back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the things that he talked about in his novels and writing about electricity were, you know, because it was relatively new. It was just things like that you just don't think about. I mean, we take electricity for granted. Fitzgerald, you know, would not have.
Right.
So there's just always stuff coming out.
Well, we're going to get to the thought book. That's the new one that you've edited, the Teenage Diary of F. Scott Fitzgerald. What? Let me ask you this, though. What makes him so compelling? Now we're 117 years on from his birth, and he's still very much on many people's minds. Is the subject of endless discussions and fascination. What is it about him?
Well, I mean, when you have Baz Luhrmann making, you know, a 3D film of The Great Gatsby, I mean, that really... I don't know if helps is the right word, but it of course puts him, you know, front and center. And then of course we had, Benjamin Button. And so, I mean, you have these incredible actors that are taking roles in, remakes of Fitzgerald's films or films that based on stories by Fitzgerald. Yeah. So, you know, Brad Pitt and
DiCaprio.
DiCaprio. I mean, so people get drawn to things like that. But you know, he was a beautiful writer, and he also just lived an incredible life.
He did.
I mean, you're drawn to that.
Right. I think really the fascination, and correct me if I'm wrong, runs on two tracks. It's about the man himself and about what he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are two endless topics of fascination.
Yeah, and there are some kind of purists who wish it would just focus on the writing, but
You can't.
I can't.
You can't. How can you separate that from what he was?
I don't.
Right. Yeah. St. Paul loves to claim F. Scott Fitzgerald. He was born here. He's ours. How did Fitzgerald regard St. Paul?
Well, I'm not.
Not with a great
sure
deal of love.
I would agree with you about St. Paul making the claim. I mean,
people do.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice if there were a little bit. You know, if we had a museum or something in St. Paul, which we'll talk about later.
Yes.
A group of us are trying to get one, but. I think he really cared a lot about St. Paul. In fact, when there was a brouhaha about the Snoopy statues and the Fitzgerald statue and all that, and somebody said, oh, Charles Schulz was this great guy and Fitzgerald was just a drunk. Well, Charles Schulz was also had drinking problems, and you don't look at Peanuts and think, oh my God, St. Paul. I mean, I don't.
Right,
but,
I don't either.
But when I read Fitzgerald's stories, I mean, the references to St. Paul are absolutely clear. Most of them are beautiful and talking about, you know, how it, and showed very much how much he loved his hometown. He talked about his hometown all the time. Mm-hmm. So he had this, admittedly, he did not like winter. But I'm assuming...
He's not alone, David.
I was going to say, I'm assuming there are a few people who live here that don't like winter. I have a lot of friends who don't stick around here in the winter.
Right.
So
lucky.
I think he also was attracted to a different type of faster pace where people were more willing to let others, you know, flaunt their... you know, their popularity, and St. Paul wasn't that kind of town. More Victorian.
More Victorian, okay. I want to read, if I may, something from a guy you know and I met, Scott Donaldson, who is one of F. Scott Fitzgerald's many biographers. And I think a pretty good one, too.
Oh, absolutely.
You agree? Okay, F. He was here back in the 90s, Scott Donaldson was, and... he autographed my book, too. It's called Fool for Love, F. Scott Fitzgerald, about the women. We'll talk about the women in F. Scott's life and how they informed his literature. But here's what Donaldson wrote, Scott Donaldson wrote, about St. Paul. He, Fitzgerald, did not live there very long and never really had a home anywhere, but St. Paul, Minnesota left its mark on Scott Fitzgerald. What sort of place was the St. Paul of Fitzgerald's youth? Most accounts characterize the city then as conservative, traditional, somewhat smug in its provincialism. St. Paul presents to the eye, writer Thomas Boyd remarked in 1922, the spectacle of a huge city clinging tenaciously to the east and alarmed over the danger of falling into the west. The word for St. Paul, writer Grace Flandreau concluded in a 1925 essay, was complacent. And as a native daughter, that was all right with her. Complacency, she says, is what we need, she insisted, with an eye on the twin city of Minneapolis across the river. She wrote, Americans and American cities suffer from a disguised inferiority complex called boosterism. If St. Paul got any bigger, she says, its citizens might well be living in Minneapolis. When Fitzgerald characterized his hometown, he emphasized something largely ignored by his friends, Flandreau and Boyd, the social hierarchy of the city. St. Paul felt itself superior to Minneapolis and to Kansas City and Indianapolis and other Midwestern cities because it was, by the first decade of the 20th century, a three-generation town, while the others could claim only two. Well, what do you think about that? Is that pretty...
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Scott Donaldson quotes Grace Flandreau, who was... that was her married name. She married... Charles Flandreau's brother. And Charles Flandreau was exactly the kind of person she was talking about. He was a mentor to F. Scott Fitzgerald. He was a famous writer in his own right, but he didn't, you know, push that. So after his novel about his college days at Harvard, kind of talking about what it was like, was published, he went on a world tour with a friend. He did not go out and promote the book. And then we have 40 years later, Fitzgerald running out in the street telling everybody about his book that was published about his college days.
And he really did do that, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
We'll get to this.
I mean,
he was waiting for his publisher to say, yeah, what turned out to be this side of paradise.
Yeah, he understood the media and how people could use the media to kind of promote themselves. And the whole idea was the Victorians wouldn't promote themselves, and so
it's amazing.
There's this break.
Just to put that back in context, when F. Scott Fitzgerald, it was 1919, about wasn't it? When he or 20 when he got the note, the letter.
Yeah,
from 1919. Living with his parents' place up on Summit Avenue.
Yep.
Finally, after writing and spending the whole summer really polishing and, and reworking what turned out to be The Side of Paradise, which would be his breakthrough, he got the letter from Scribner's, his publisher, and said, yes, you're going to be published. He really did run out into the street, Summit Avenue, stopped any cars he could, and said, they're going to publish me.
That's what I did when I got my first book published. So
me too. Funny. Isn't that coincidental?
I think we all did, except I got hit by the car. I was the difference.
And mine didn't sell at all. Okay. We're talking with Dave Page, expert here on F. Scott Fitzgerald. Next Tuesday marks the 117th anniversary of F. Scott's birth. There's a new book out, and yes, David, we will get to it. It's called The Thought Book of F. Scott Fitzgerald, his teenage diary, where we see really the birth of a writer, and we're going to get to that. Kyle, let's take a break. We'll be right back with Dave Page.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barber shop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
Did you know we had fingerprints before we were even born?
We did?
Yep, when we were only 9 weeks old.
My mom says our hearts were beating too.
Well, my mom says I could suck my thumb and smile before I was even born.
You still do. You don't have to tell.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski, and I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of information and alternatives, including adoption, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please call 1-800-366-7773 or visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org. Pro-Life Across America, non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
And we are back here. It's 12:22 here on this Saturday afternoon. We're about 55 degrees, off and on sunshine, mostly clouds right now. Let's see, just to give you a quick heads up on the weather here for the balance of the day. The National Weather Service still says sunny. I guess that's yet to come. High near 64, and the winds light tonight. Overnight low 45 degrees. Clear skies, so that's what you got. Oh, yeah, Sunday. We should tell you about that, too. Sunny tomorrow, say the forecasters, and a high near 71. So there you go. We're back here now with Dave Page, expert on F. Scott Fitzgerald. Dave's local here. He teaches at Inver Hills College, right?
Community? Yes, Inver Hills.
Thank you. Get that right. In Inver Grove Heights.
Absolutely.
Okay, we got that right. And you teach writing, and from time to time you do a class on F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you a lot of people like that, don't they? Huh? Even the kids know him, at least something about him, don't they? And a lot when they get done with your class.
Yeah, maybe more than they want. I don't know.
Well, here we are. David has just edited what's called The Thought Book of F. Scott Fitzgerald, A Secret Boyhood Diary. Wow. This is F. Scott writing in this little diary, age, what, about 14?
Yes, he's about 14, 15.
14 years old. The year's about 1910 or so, right around
there.
Yeah,
1909, 1910. 1910,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the significance of this. Where has it been all these years? Just give us kind of the backstory on the so-called, he called it a thought book, not a diary. Huh?
Right, and yeah, that's an interesting title. I'm still not quite sure where he got that from, but people knew that this was around because many of his papers had been saved, but most people presumed that it was at Princeton because that's where his daughter had donated all his papers. Mm-hmm. And when the University of Minnesota Press called me really early, you know, like January, February 2012, and asked me if I wanted to, you know, take on this project, and I said, sure, and everybody's presumption was that this thought book was at Princeton, and I don't know when it was. I finally emailed the librarian at Princeton, and I was talking about the thought book, and he emailed me back and said, we don't have it. And I emailed some of my colleagues. I mean, you know, people who were, you know, who had sworn that they'd seen the thought book at Princeton, and they said, no, we saw it there. And he wrote back and said, we don't have it. So it became this kind of mystery of what happened to the thought book, and people were telling me it had been stolen. et cetera, et cetera.
Fitzgerald would have loved it.
Probably. I mean, just he wrote these early mysteries, yeah. And so I actually eventually tracked it down at the University of South Carolina because Matthew Bruckley had it. Now, how he got his hands on it, I'm not totally sure, but he was really good friends with Scotty. And
Fitzgerald's daughter.
Yeah, Fitzgerald's
and
daughter,
Bruckley
Scotty.
Was an acknowledged, like you, an expert on, well...
Yeah, very... Yeah,
expert on F. Scott.
Yeah,
Hemingway.
The expert yeah. on, yeah. on
okay.
Fitzgerald.
Okay,
and so
he had it.
He must have got his paws on it somehow, somewhere, and at some
somehow,
time, and
huh?
he wasn't going to give it up.
Okay. It's a small little thing. It only runs a few pages.
Yeah, it's only, gosh, it's right. only about 14 pages long, lined notebook paper.
Yep.
And so, I mean, I tracked all that down, and then one of, Stu Wilson, who's actually running the group that we'll be talking about a little bit later, knows the librarian at the University of South Carolina and kind of had to rub it in that he was going to visit and get to see the thought book. And I was going, oh, geez. He went there, he said it was like James Bond. He said they actually had to do a retina scan to get in to see the thought book. I mean...
Oh, come on.
Oh, no. I'm not joking. I mean, he wouldn't make that up. It's underground. I don't know how many stories. And, of course, humidity controlled, temperature controlled, and, like, all these different gates you have to get through.
The gold at Fort Knox has less security than this thing.
Possibly. I mean, Fitzgerald stuff sells for...
Wow.
Just so much money.
Yeah. Okay, the thought book, the contents of it. Here we have the adolescent, the boy, the 14-year-old F. Scott, Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald.
Oh, yeah.
Time, yeah. And he's keeping this diary. And is he in St. Paul or Buffalo, New York, or both?
He's in St. Paul, but in some of the passages, he's remembering being in Buffalo.
All right.
And so the first seven pages supposedly are missing. I don't know if they were never there. I don't know if his mother destroyed him. I don't know if his daughter destroyed him. But, you know, this is a big mystery. Or if they were stolen. His school, the plays that he'd written when he was a young man were at St. Paul Academy. All of them were stolen.
Mm.
So it wouldn't be surprising if some Fitzgerald stuff was stolen.
Or ripped off.
You know, and so...
Well, Dave Page, the significance of the diary, the thought book,
yes.
What is it?
There was a young woman by the name of Violet Stockton who had visited, and she had this kind of secret diary, and he and his friends stole it. So we think that he got his idea for keeping his diary from Violet's diary. And,
which he had stolen with another friend.
Which he had stolen, but they gave
there's an auspicious literary start.
Yeah, they gave it back. And what's interesting is he had written a couple other earlier things that are extant. I mean, there's some stuff that supposedly disappeared. And the movement from that early stuff to the thought book is pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so that early stuff was pretty poorly written. But by the time we get to the thought book, and he is older, you know, he's 14.
Yeah.
It's the writing is not bad.
Well, it's good. You know, it's more of a journal than a diary. I mean, he's actually writing here. This
yeah.
is prose almost. It's not just today I went to the cigar store
right.
and tried to get some cigarettes illegally. Nothing like that. And words, and if I could, David, and you'll read for us here. But I just... mark some words here. This is a 14-year-old kid. I think this is pretty good. He uses it. Nancy, about 8, and we were quite infatuated. He uses the word infatuated. I then and there resolved that I would, I had secured the coveted first place. Uses the word relinquished it to Johnny Gowns. And just one more here that just tells you this man's gift for words at such a young age. Remarkable. He writes, I devote a whole chapter to these two because for a long time they were my ideals, but lately one has fallen in my estimation. For a long time I was, Paul's ardent admirer. I mean, how many 14-year-olds use them? It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
He couldn't spell worth a darn.
No.
And he never could, even through adulthood.
Spelling was atrocious.
It was.
There's kind of a funny story about that later, too.
Okay.
But Violet, the passage he wrote about her, Violet Stockton was a niece of Mrs. Finch. And she spent a summer in St. Paul. She was very pretty with dark brown eyes big and soft. She spoke with a soft southern accent, leaving out the R's. She was a year older than I, but together with most of the other boys, liked her very much.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what he's writing about Violet Stockton when she's, you know, when he's 14, and then later when he's like, you know, in his late 20s, he writes about her. He calls her Ermine Gilbert Labouie's Bibble. In the story, he thinks he's wonderful, and he writes, Ermine Gilbert Labouie's Bibble was in exile. Her parents had brought her from New Orleans and Southampton in May, hoping that the active outdoor life proper to a girl of 15 would take her thoughts from love. But north or south, a storm of sapling arrows flew about her.
Wow.
She was engaged before the 1st of June. Let it not be gathered from the foregoing that the somewhat hard outlines of Miss Bibble at 20 had already begun to appear. She was of a radiant freshness. Her head had reminded otherwise not illiterate young men of damp blue violets pierced with blue windows that looked into a bright soul.
Right. Now, these are the words of F. Susskind later in life.
But drawing clearly from the thought book. So when you're talking about its importance, I mean, he used it later
to write
these wonderful stories.
It became a reference for him,
absolutely,
basically, didn't it? And you see his ability to, his character development, description
mm-hmm.
is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Dialogue, too. The guy does dialogue in his little diary, too, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's a great scene between Violet and Scott in the book as well.
Yeah, there is. And it's very sophisticated, again, for a kid 14 years old. The gift, I guess none of us can know where the gift of writing comes from. He certainly had it in spades. Just amazing.
And I would also argue that it's not just a gift, that he worked really hard. I mean, how many 14-year-olds are bothering to write and rewrite? Even back then,
they were more interested in literary things, but maybe not so much. But he did study. Did he have any heroes in the literary world, any models that he tried to pattern himself after?
There was an author by the name of Henty who wrote a bunch of those historical fiction books, and he copied some of Henty's stuff. So, I mean, he was doing the same thing a painter would do. I mean, he would copy these literary, ideals, as he called them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he worked at it. I mean, I'm sure there was probably a gift, but also the thing you have to remember is the work.
Yes, 2% inspiration and 98%.
Oh, yeah,
98%.
Was that Sinclair Lewis?
I think so. Hemingway, too, had to open a vein and bleed when he wrote. He wrote 15 different endings to Farewell to Arms on the last sentence.
Yeah.
So they did work at it. It just didn't
Didn't
have a martini in one hand and just kind of fell asleep and wrote it, you know, in their subconscious. They really did. So this is a fascinating work then. We see this man in the formative stages of a great writer.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Fitzgerald, this is the man who would go on. You mentioned Great Gatsby, the latest movie. There have been at least three or four of them. What did you think of the DiCaprio one, the one that came out not so many months ago?
I loved the movie, actually. And
David, I'm surprised you. I thought you were going to say, it's one of the worst things I've ever seen.
You know what? I had a friend who emailed me and said it was terrible and that she walked out of it, but somehow she was able to explain to me what happened at the end. So. I'm not really sure. Didn't walk out too long, did she?
Maybe to get some popcorn and come back.
I thought it was just great.
Really?
I thought he really captured what Fitzgerald was trying to capture. And even if there was some, you know, rap music in the movie, and even if he did, you know, kind of a car chase and...
Yep.
I thought he did really, really well, and I actually wrote him a fan letter.
Really?
Yeah, because I...
Are you talking about DiCaprio?
No, Baz Luhrmann, because I don't know why. It's like, you know, he was getting so pounded on by all the reviewers, and I wanted him to know that there was one person who had written a couple books about Fitzgerald who thought it was a really... you know, good movie, and I was hoping he would send me something back for my collection, but he didn't. So now I think it's a rotten. No, no, he didn't send anything back yet. But no, I thought it was great.
I thought the actor, forgive me for forgetting his name, who portrayed Nick Carraway, is deserving of an Academy Award. I thought he's true. Why can't I get his name?
You know what? I can't think of it either.
Yeah, what's wrong with this, Kyle? You don't know either, do you? Huh?
I'm pretty sure it's the guy that played Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yes.
And his name is?
I don't know. I can hear people right now.
Yeah, they're going to be mad at us.
Don't you guys know? Anyway.
So the people are coming down the hall now to tell us.
Right. I thought he did a fascinating job.
You know, and I thought DiCaprio was a better Gatsby
than Redford
because of the fact that, you know, DiCaprio can be a little bit of a, you know, jerk, and Gatsby was.
Yep.
And the hard part, of course, is Daisy. I mean, she makes or breaks the movie because she's got this really hard role. So.
Right.
So when I thought the woman who played Daisy, and I can't remember her name, I'm sorry.
We're having a rough day here.
I'm at that age where every day's pretty rough.
Brain fade here on Saturday afternoon.
But folks listening, they know
what we're talking about,
they know. If they saw the movie, they know.
Of course they do. Do you have the name? No, nobody came in with a name yet.
They came in and said it was Tobey Maguire.
Yes. Tobey Maguire, of course. I knew it all the time. Thanks, Tom Osmond, for that one. Yeah, Tobey Maguire. Great actor. You agree? He did as good a job as anybody in that film. That was terrific.
As I said, I thought the film was great. I thought it was better than the 1974 film.
Wow. I was not expecting that from you today. I'm glad to hear it. I enjoyed it, too. It was great.
Yeah.
Fitzgerald, we can talk all about his literature, and we could. You and Pat Hample have edited a collection of the St. Paul stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald. We talked about his feeling towards St. Paul, much more positive than I ever thought it was. I thought that he didn't much care, just would soon have forgotten that let people know that he came from St. Paul, but not so.
I think, you know, he and Zelda moved back here after, you know, their marriage in New York City, and they traveled around the world, and they, you know, came back to Montgomery for a while, and I think Fitzgerald was probably happy here. He was with his friends, the very, very good friends he had made at a young age. He was able to feel as though he was, you know, making it in the world. He was kind of famous. My guess is that Zelda didn't really like it here very well.
Oh, she hated it. She said so. She hated it. Especially the winters.
And that's the easy thing. But
she was from Montgomery, Alabama, after all.
Yeah, that's the easy thing to say. But I also think... and I'm not disagreeing with that. I mean, the month that Scotty was born, there were like 5 days of sunshine, you know, so you can imagine someone from the South not really wanting to deal with that. But I also think, you know, she smoked, she drank, she flirted. I mean, I think the women in the North just did not get kind of her Southern ways, and they did not like her.
Uh-huh. And she didn't like them right back, I guess.
She only had like one female friend in town, and the rest of the women hated her because all their husbands loved her.
And when she was over in the Riviera, she got hooked up with a French aviator, too.
Who said he was a gentleman and would never talk about it.
And he never did, did he?
And he never did.
Never did, okay.
He never did.
Well, obviously the people in St. Paul were... Fitzgerald had some affection. Certainly, the people here populated some of his novels.
You know, absolutely.
No question about it.
Yeah.
Just if you could just touch on some of the St. Paul stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I read that earlier scene was from He Thinks He's Wonderful.
Right.
He wrote the Basil Duke Lee stories, which are probably the most autobiographical of that time when the thought book was being kept. So you're running across people like Marie Hersey, who showed up in the stories as, I think it was Margaret Torrance, and her father was a lumber baron. She lived in a house on Summit Avenue, and the important thing about Marie Hersey later on is that she introduced Scott to her roommate.
Oh, boy.
Ginevra King.
Ginevra King, the love of his life.
The love of his life.
No question, and that's a thread through many of his novels.
Well, his women are a mixture of... You know, Ginevra and Zelda.
And we're going to talk about F. Scott and his women here as we kind of using the thought book of F. Scott Fitzgerald as a takeoff point here, because it really is seminal, isn't it? It really is
I think the first chapter is called Me and My Women or something like that.
That would get right to it. Yeah. We'll be back with Dave Page, F. Scott Fitzgerald, this legendary and fascinating literary figure from St. Paul, Minnesota, right after this.
The 1920s were a golden age for baseball and custom-tailored clothing. That golden age is back at Jaime's Haberdashery in St. Paul. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Make each visit uniquely yours with hats, suits, casual wear, and accessories. Visit their barber shop for a hot lather shave. It's the golden age again at Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at jaimes.com.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
Car and driver make a perfect match with the 2013 Buick LaCrosse at Stillwater Motors. Over 90 years, generations of customers have relied on Stillwater Motors for quality and integrity second to none. 2013 Buick LaCrosse continues that promise with luxury and value to spare. LaCrosse turns heads with bold styling inside and out. Details like French seam stitching, wood-grained accents, and other high-quality materials give LaCrosse style high above its price. Choose LaCrosse with E-Assist and get an EPA estimated 36 highway miles per gallon.
I'm Michael Kahn for Stillwater Motors. Buick LaCrosse with E-Assist offers affordable luxury and high mileage. We have your Buick in stock and we won't be undersold.
Quality, integrity, and history. Why shop anywhere else? The 2013 Buick LaCrosse at Stillwater Motors. Highway 36 and Stillwater Boulevard. Right on the corner and right on the price. Redund's family owned and operated since 1922.
Back we are at 1241. Stan Turner here. Thank you so much for your company. As we've been saying here, next Tuesday marks the 117th anniversary of the birth of F. Scott Fitzgerald, St. Paul's own. Great novelist, short story writer, and fascinating figure. Dave Page knows as much, and I'm going to say it, Dave, as much as anybody can know about. I know you're going to say, no, but you do know a ton about F. Scott Fitzgerald. Dave is a local writer here and a teacher at the college level, and he has edited a brand new book called The Thought Book of F. Scott Fitzgerald, A Secret Boyhood Diary, kept by F. Scott Fitzgerald under his bed, under lock and key, and it would serve as a reference for him as he grew older and started writing. In his teens and twenties, So he reached back to this teenage diary to populate his later novels with figures he knew from St. Paul. David, this book, The Thought Book of F. Scott Fitzgerald, is a good springboard to a lot of events going on around here. And please tell us where you're going to be and what's going on.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, F. Scott Fitzgerald in St. Paul is a new nonprofit. We're trying to, we would like to get a museum started in St. Paul, and so we have been doing a couple smaller events, and kind of the introductory event is going to be September 24th at the James J. Hill House. Unfortunately, it's sold out.
Or fortunately, as the case might be. That's pretty good. That's a compliment.
Well,
it
was free. So
when they say sold out, love free.
I know. So... But unfortunately, no more tickets are available,
okay.
I should say.
Okay.
There's another event at the History Center on October 15th. It's, I'm not sure of the time. I think I have 2 p.m. I'm not quite sure of that. You might want to check that up. That's at the History Center. I'll be at Subtext Bookstore at 7 p.m. on October 8th and Majors and Quinn October 22nd, and there's a couple other things going on, but the fact that the event at the James J. Hill House is full doesn't surprise me. I mean, every time we do an event about Fitzgerald, people come out.
This man has curb appeal, matinee appeal.
Oh,
he
yeah.
certainly does. He's a star.
Yeah,
17 years after his birth.
When we the man who is funding the F. Scott Fitzgerald in St. Paul, Richard McDermott, passed away recently, and he lived in the birthplace apartment. And when we had that apartment named a national literary landmark, not a national historic site, but a national literary landmark, we threw a birthday party, and I said I would bring cake, and I said how much, and they said, well, you know, maybe 50 people will show up. I thought not. There were like 200 people there. We blocked the street.
This is Laurel Avenue.
Yeah, at 481 Forward. Laurel, right. And fortunately, I bought a big cake. I was the only one that didn't get a piece, but that's... That's okay.
That's great. That's all right, David. That's a great story. You had mentioned, is that pretty well cover the appearances here in the immediate future? Okay, there'll be more. Just keep, we'll pass them along here on the air, too, when they come along. You mentioned Ginevra King, who was, by any account, the love of Fitzgerald's life, jilted by her, this wealthy, beautiful lady. from Illinois, from the...
Luke Forrest.
Yep. And famously said, was it her father who said, rich girls don't marry poor boys?
We think it was her father who probably said that. And that worked its way into the 1974 movie. It was not in the novel, but that's really interesting that somebody bothered to put that wonderful line into the movie.
Anyway, she threw him over. They had a little fling, not much of one. More platonic, I'm sure, just a relationship that was...
It went on for, about, I don't know, over a year, I think, but it was mostly letters.
A lot of letters.
They saw each other twice, maybe.
Right. And what, her letters to him, when they were...
He did a kind of a funny thing.
Yeah.
She just, I think, you know, she didn't really keep his letters, and she wanted him to destroy hers.
Right.
And so he promised to, but he had them all typed up first. and so he destroyed the letters, but he had them. And then later, Scotty actually met with Ginevra and gave her the bound letters that Fitzgerald had typed.
Amazing. So this is his first love, and Ginevra King, her real name, she and many other guises, under many other names and many other novels, appears throughout Fitzgerald's literary life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of, I think of Hemingway and Agnes von Karowski.
Oh, yeah.
The nurse who tended to him when he was wounded in Italy during World War I, and he never got over that one, just Scott never got over Ginevra King. And they both didn't like their mothers very well either, did they?
Yeah, and it's really interesting about, you know, do you have to suffer for your art? And, you know, Hemingway and Fitzgerald supposedly suffered for their art, and that's why I'm not a great writer, because I am very, very happily married.
That's beautifully put, Dave Page.
And probably necessary.
And your wife is sitting right out here in the waiting room, too.
Yeah,
so.
my wonderful, beautiful wife is sitting right out there, so I have to say that. But, if she ever leaves me, I'll become just this incredible writer.
Yep, okay. Did you hear that out there, Mrs. Page? Well, other women in F. Scott's life.
Zelda
Sayer.
And then later, way at the end of his life, the woman who helped him get dry was Sheila Graham. Mm-hmm. He never left Zelda. He always paid, you know, for her hospitalization, but Sheila Graham kind of became an industry. I think she wrote 4 books about Fitzgerald because, you know, she could, and they sold. And so she was a Hollywood gossip columnist, and he died in her apartment out in Los Angeles, and the apartment is still there.
May I read this? Because I think this dovetails with what you just said, and this is from another biographer. There are the woods are full of Fitzgerald biographies. This one by Pregosi, is that
Ruth Pregosi. She's a great friend.
Pretty good small little bio. She writes, in the last year of Fitzgerald's life, that would be 1940, he was only 44 years old, Fitzgerald had earned less than $15 in royalty payments, and although 6 of his works were still in print, he was a forgotten man. Indeed, when young Bud Schulberg was assigned the task of collaborating with Fitzgerald on a screenplay in 1939, Schulberg was surprised, thinking the older writer, Fitzgerald, was long since dead. Newspapers noting Fitzgerald's death viewed him as a relic of the jazz age, and few were willing to concede to him more than, in the words of the New York Times, a real talent which never fully bloomed. Wow, what a bad ending.
Yeah, and then Meisner came along in 1951 and with The Far Side of Paradise.
It's a biography of the first full-fledged biography.
Yeah, and resurrected him, and people started rereading him, and then the train has never left the tracks. It's still chugging along, and I don't know. It could go on for a long time. I mean, it was a time when there could be a Hemingway, a Fitzgerald, a Wolf, and I don't know if today, because of the media, that can happen again.
Expand on that. That's an interesting point.
Well, there's so much diversity out there that, I mean, Fitzgerald could actually capture a large part of the media market, but today? I mean, you know, yeah, you can be a Kardashian, and of course, they're playing off Fitzgerald and Zelda. I mean, being celebrities, but Fitzgerald, there was a reason, but... Yeah, I would think it's going to be really difficult because of the changing, publishing industry. A lot of people are self-publishing. It's going to be really hard for another Fitzgerald to exist. So maybe that's another reason why, the people of that era will continue to fascinate us, because they're going to be the last big names, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Why did Fitzgerald fall off the map toward the end of his life, though? That's a heat. Look, a great Gatsby, Tender as the Night, you know, This Side of Paradise, a whole string of big, big novels we today regard as bestsellers. They not all were during his lifetime,
no.
though, were they?
No. His first novel sold pretty well. The others, not so well. He made most of his money from short stories and movies. That, you know, the Depression hurt. I mean, people saw him or thought of him as just a writer about the rich, and people weren't excited about reading about the rich, so you have the rise of somebody like John Steinbeck. Mm-hmm. And so he started, you know, losing his audience, and to be honest, he started losing his edge. I mean, he just drank too much, and he just can't continue drinking like that. In fact, I just read a recent article that some people speculate that that's what Zelda's problem was, because she was drinking bad bathtub gin, and that's what made her crazy.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, so, I mean, you just...
The
you
poor
know.
Lady died in a locked attic in a sanitarium.
Yeah,
she was
in
trapped
Asheville.
In there and couldn't get out
fire.
And burned to death.
Yeah.
This was after F. Scott's death.
Yeah, she died in 48.
Okay. Tell us what is meant by some analysts of Fitzgerald, his double vision. Now, he had this strange kind of dichotomy almost, where he was entranced by the wealthy. He grew up on their periphery in St. Paul, mm-hmm. yet he always claimed to back off and not be part of them. But he wanted to be part of them, didn't he? And was
well,
he part of them?
Yeah, he was. I mean, his grandfather, Philip McQuillan, had the largest mansion, larger than James J. Hill, down in Lower Town, when you know, at that point. And so... Fitzgerald was part of that society. I think the double vision came not because he wasn't part of it. He definitely was. I mean, he was like a millionaire amongst billionaires. You don't feel sorry for the millionaire. but he was able to kind of step back, I think, from that, possibly because his parents weren't accepted by their parents. His father had not been a successful businessman. So he was able to have that double vision. He wrote about it all the time, able to be at the party and also then wonder what it was like looking in the window at the party.
Do we see that in The Gatsby?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure? That's what it's all about, isn't it?
Well, and he writes about it directly. He's at the party up at Tom and Myrtle's apartment in New York City, and he wonders what it's like for people outside looking up at them. And so he really, you know, he had that, you know, that double vision existed. I mean, and so he could be objective about what he was, you know, doing with the rich. And so I think a lot of critics appreciate that.
Yes, yes. And also, along this line, look at his... He kept a ledger. Part of it was, you know, expenses and income and outgo.
Yeah.
But you know what? He was pretty hard on himself, wasn't he? I mean, he would talk about his drinking. I mean, he didn't spare himself in private. When F. Scott was writing to himself in this ledger, he was brutally candid about his own bad behavior, wasn't he?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. But once again, the ledger may not have been started till he was in his 20s, and so I think he'd been taken down a few notches by then. The thought book is not like that at all. Everything is upbeat in the thought book. But yeah, in the ledger, he talked about, you know, that he was embarrassed about his feet and things like that. I mean, he was very honest about his weaker moment feelings, yeah.
And he berated himself for excessive drinking from time to time, too.
Absolutely.
He said, "I made a mess last night, I'm buried."
He was apologizing all the time on Sunday morning.
Yeah. And his bad behavior was bad in some cases. He was a bad drunk, there was no question about it.
Yeah, he was a very bad drunk, but at the same time, he was one of the most generous writers that you could talk about. He helped so many other writers. Hemingway, for example. He helped Thomas Boyd. He helped anybody that came along. He would put down his own writing to help them.
And what did he get back from Hemingway? He got
the
movable
deep.
Feast where Hemingway, who wrote this years after the years in the 20s, just put daggers into F. Scott's back and front and side.
And the worst thing Hemingway said about him was that he was a bad dresser, because Fitzgerald never dressed badly. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
He got that from his father, who was a fop, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Right? David Page, what are the best works of F. Scott Fitzgerald in your estimation?
Well, I still love The Great Gatsby. It's my favorite. And then the short stories. I mean, Winter Dreams is fantastic. And, of course, that's a St. Paul story.
Yes,
The Ice Palace is a fantastic story. I love the Basil story. So, I mean, those are just...
They are.
tremendously beautifully written, still, you know, appealed to me when I was younger, appeal to me now. I still get different things out of them. So, yeah, great stories, great novel.
Some analysts have said that Fitzgerald was more of a writer of the 19th century, while Hemingway was a 20th century writer in style.
Yeah, possibly.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah, Hemingway was definitely looking forward. I think the thing about Fitzgerald is that he took young people very seriously. And that's probably why I think he's still relevant today, because young people can read him and, you know, he doesn't mock them. I mean, he acts as though all these things that are crises in their life, although we can look back and say they're not crises, but he takes it seriously. You know, the need for a car, the need for long pants, oh my God, you know. And back then, it really, it was important.
Right. Does F. Scott Fitzgerald, to your mind, rank in the top tier of American literary figures?
Oh, absolutely.
Right up there.
Oh, absolutely. Right, no doubt in my mind at all.
Is Hemingway there with him?
I like Hemingway. So, you know.
You wouldn't like him personally, though. I don't know, man.
I'd be a little afraid of him, maybe.
Yeah. He was a bully.
He was a bully. But you know what? I bet he would have been a lot of fun to be around.
Oh, yeah. Especially, well, yeah, we know he was. Until he put the boxing gloves on, Dave, and wanted to go a couple rounds with him, then he wouldn't like him so much.
I'd go in the ring with him. I don't think he was that good of a boxer. He was just a bully.
He was a bully.
People who knew how to box could stay in the ring with him.
Right. What else about F. Scott should we know? Maybe people are not so aware of.
I've already touched on two things that I think are really important.
Okay.
He took young people seriously, and the fact that most people think he was this kind of waif standing outside the window with his kind of a Dickensian figure, you know, with his nose pressed to the window wondering what it was like to be at the wealthy parties. He was there. I mean, he didn't write these beautiful things because he was imagining it. He wrote these beautiful things because he was there. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly talking to people about that.
Yes.
I think the other thing is he was the Catholic Church was very, very, very important to him. He had a falling out with the Catholic Church, but I think it still influenced him. And you know, he talked about that. You know, he could never get the Catholic Church out of him.
Mm-hmm. A Monsignor in St. Paul was very important to him. Faye, I think his name was.
He was in New Jersey.
New Jersey, was
yeah,
he?
That's
okay.
Where he met him. And Fitzgerald could have been a priest. He was.
Well, he thought about it.
Absolutely.
He actually did think about it.
Yeah.
I think it was when he entered the. I think when he entered the military during World War I that he said, "That's it. I'm done with the Catholic Church."
Yeah, I think when he kind of started getting interested in women, I think is when he said, "That's it. I'm done with the Catholic Church."
Hemingway was not good to women, just by temperament. I think by drinking and all, he wasn't. You just look through the four.
Fitzgerald probably didn't treat Zelda as well as he should have. I will admit that. Yeah.
Was she a good writer?
She was an okay writer.
Save Me the Waltz?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there are parts of that are pretty good. Yeah. But
did he steal from some of her writing?
Of course he did. But that's what husbands do.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that's what husbands do, what writers do. I mean, they're stealing from Shakespeare today. But it's hard to imagine Zelda without Scott. I mean, I don't think Save Me the Waltz would have been published if she hadn't been F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife.
Right.
And maybe it would have. Today it would have, as I said, because of the opportunities out there. But back then, you know, the publishing houses had pretty locked control. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say. She was a great dancer. She was a great artist. She was an incredible athlete. But she was also F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife, and that gave her a lot of publicity.
And she might have been drinking bad booze, wood alcohol that might have messed up her mind.
Yeah.
That's an interesting theory.
Yeah, I read recently that some people speculate that that's what maybe drove her a little bit mad.
All right. Kyle, how much time do we have left here? We've got about a minute? So I just want to say about that. Dave, do you still do tours? Have Scott Fitzgerald lived here, worked
I'm
here?
I'm actually the International Jane Austen Society is meeting here in the Twin Cities in September. I'm giving three tours. This month, I'm giving three tours to Jane Austen fanatics, F. Scott Fitzgerald tours.
Oh, shit. Now, she didn't live here.
No. But, you know,
Heller was here.
Jane Austen fanatics, of course, are going to be F. Scott Fitzgerald fanatics.
Well, of course
as well.
They are.
Yeah.
David, thank you. Once again, the more immediate appearances you're going to be doing next Tuesday?
Yeah, the big one is at the History Center on October 15th, and then Subtext October 8th, and Majors and Quinn October 22nd.
Okay, and next Tuesday night at the Hill House, that's a sellout.
Yeah, but that's
a sellout. Okay. All right. Dave Page, thank you so much. It's wonderful to hook up with you again. We first met 1996 with all these Fitzgerald things going. And
you're making me feel old.
Oh, no, you're just a kid. I can describe to the audience right now. You're still in short pants, Dave. Thanks for coming up here. We appreciate it. Everybody, thank you for listening. Twin Cities Flashback coming up next year with Tom Osmond. Stay with it here. Thank you. Stan Turner, have a great weekend. Bye.